WEFT as a nonprofit beneficiary of your gift. WEFT truly appreciates supporters like you.
Good evening. It is just 6 p.m. Well, maybe 6:01 p.m. now here on WEFT 90.1 FM radio. My name is Ben. This is the program where we are at. I am live in the studio. Just to let you know that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT Associates. I want to say that I'm coming up on 8 years at being at WEFT. I did have another show sort of before this, same type of show, kind of talking about politics and news. I think right around, because I remember it was right around the primary, so I've been here at WEFT 90.1 FM for 8 years, and boy, it sure goes fast, I tell you. What you heard just a little while ago was Miles Davis and John Coltrane, the Bootleg Series Volume. It was a lot played on a live concert. I believe it was on Green Dolphin Street was the track there that you heard. Just letting you know, here at WEFT, we are doing a bit of a spring donation drive, hoping to get to $10,000. All donations, from what I understand, will be matched. All donations during the WFT spring donation drive will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000. So if you can, we would donate today. If you can, you can go to weft.org, and I believe if you go on our app, there should be a way to donate there on our WFT 90.1 FM app on Apple Store or in Google Play Store. If I'm mistaken, then I apologize. You can also mail a check or cash. I imagine we'd take both to here on our WEFT, at our WEFT station. You would just write on the letter that you're forwarding address, WEFT 90.1 FM, P.O. Box 1223, Champaign, Illinois, and then the zip code is 61824. If you also, technically it's 61824 with a little hyphen 1223, but if that's your preferred way of donating, which we'll gladly take and very much appreciate, because we are a volunteer run station. We're essentially we run on our listeners' supports, and that means donations, and so we have to do these kind of spring donation, these types of donation drives in spring. So it's a great time if you have some money you can spare and you would like to give it to us, we'll gladly take it, and we'll thank you so much and grateful for this. And it's March Match Madness. Given that it's March Madness, congratulations to the men's Fighting Illini men's basketball team for making it to the Final Four. First time, last time that happened was 2005. So we're really excited about that. I know a lot of people here in Champaign are excited about that, and we're excited to see them win, especially against the Iowa Hawkeyes. But we have a something called Match Madness 2026. Thanks to everyone who has donated to the WEFT 2026 Spring Donation Drive Match Madness. There's still time to give. Return to the form you received in the mail with your check, or donate again as usual online at weft.org. You should see, once you go to the weft.org or website, there should be a blue donate now button. Thank you. We also, again, since we are supported by our listeners and supporters, we like, or as I said, we're grateful for them, and we even have some of them who we would like to thank. Thank you to Judith in Monticello. Thank you to Jeff, who is supporting Jazz on WEFT. Thanks to Barbara in Urbana. Thank you to Richard, who loves Lori's Blues Show. Thanks to Elton in Ogden for supporting WEFT. Thanks to Wayne and Lorraine in Champaign. Thanks to Susan in Champaign. Thank you to Richard for his support of Jazz and the Blues. Thank you to Nancy and John in Champaign. Thanks to Robert in Urbana. Thank you to Dean and Nancy in Savoy. Hey, I used to live there. Thanks to Marlene in Urbana and the World Waves Show. And that's all I have here for all. So thank you to those wonderful supporters. We really do really appreciate it, because you know we run on our donations. That's how we're running on. That's how the station is running, and you know we've been running since 1981. Hopefully we'll keep running for another, what, that's 1981. 40, that's 45 years. So hopefully we'll run for another 45 years. Public service announcement, some house cleaning, I like to say. Have you ever wanted to have your own radio show on here on WFT Radio 90.1 FM? It's a lot of fun. The next round of air shifter training will be happening at 3 p.m. on Sunday, April 19th, here at the radio station WFT. We're located at 113 North Market Street in downtown Champaign. Air shifter is what we call our radio host, because you are in charge of your own show. We don't tell you what to do on your show, whether it be music or a talk show. WFT's air shifter training is a great place to start if you're wanting to learn all about hosting your own show on WFT. To get in on this next round of training, go to weft.org and download the air shifter application, or send an email to station manager, that's all one word, station manager, stationmanager, at weft.org to get more information. We'll give a shout out to the Rose Bowl Tavern. There you have music. They have a lot of fun stuff going on. There's the Urbana Hootenanny. I think the Tumbleweeds. Let's see. This is March. I'm trying to look at what. I believe the Urbana Hootenanny are playing tonight. There's also U of I Jazz. Trivia night is usually Wednesdays at 7:30, followed by Jazz Jam. But there's a lot of music performances and fun stuff happening at the Rose Bowl in Urbana. So if you want to know what's going on at the Rose Bowl, go to www.rosebowl.com.
rosebowltavern.com.
I'm going to do a quick weather report because it looks like there will be some weather you might want to look out for here in Champaign. It's 62 degrees out right now, but let's look at the forecast for the week. There's a 47% chance of thunderstorms tomorrow morning. 78 is the high, 43 is the low, so I'll probably drop. I'll probably do what it usually does and drop to, the temperature will drop as it gets later in the night, tomorrow night. Wednesday, 66% chance of rain for Wednesday, so get ready for that on Wednesday, and it looks like it'll even drop into the 48 degrees Wednesday night, still with a chance of rain, 55% chance of rain. Thursday, windy with morning showers, 73 degrees in the morning on Thursday, evolving to a steady soaking rain in the afternoon. High is the 73 and some 25 to 35 mile per hour some winds. So very likely chance of rain, according to this forecast, on Thursday. Thursday night, windy with thunderstorms during the evening, followed by occasional showers overnight. So Thursday's going to look like it's going to be a rainy with thunderstorms later in the evening, night on Thursday. And then Friday, cloudy with occasional showers, 72 degrees the high, 60 degrees at night with very likely chance of, according to this, 82% chance of rain showers and numerous thunderstorms developing overnight. 60 degrees with being low, 10 to 20 miles per hour on Friday. It's Saturday, for those of you who perhaps may be driving to Indianapolis, since that's pretty close by, for the Final Four, since Illinois will be playing Saturday. Maybe some of you know somebody will be going, but Saturday, thunderstorms in the morning, windy during the afternoons, high is 67 during the day. So if you're out and about Saturday and maybe you're going to Indianapolis for the Final Four, just be prepared for that if you're driving there or however you get around. But for tomorrow, if for those of you getting ready for work or going to class, there is a 47% chance of scattered thunderstorms in the morning with cloudy skies late and some wind gusts and possibly small hail. But 78 is the high, and then showers and thunderstorms likely tomorrow night with 43 degrees being the low. I am going to play my pre-recorded news program that I have ready. I believe it's have it all queued up. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker. Do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. I believe what you're about to hear is breakthrough news.
Breakthrough.
Welcome to Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman. Now to our first story.
I'm Rachel with Breakthrough News, and we're here in New York City, where hundreds of thousands of people have come out for No King's Day, rejecting the Trump agenda. Millions across the United States are participating in No King's Day. The last No King's Day was the largest demonstration in U.S. history. This comes on the heels of the general strike in Minneapolis, which many people here are referencing. We see signs saying, "Stand with Minneapolis." We see signs saying, "No war on Iran."
For jobs and education!
I see that you're holding a banner about a general strike for May 1st. Why are you holding this banner, and what do you mean about a general strike?
Yeah, because there's power in solidarity. We saw it in Minnesota, okay? When the people get together, when they walk out of work, when they walk out of school, when they stand in the street and demand that we be treated like the full human beings that we are, and say that these federal forces are not good for us, they're hurting our people, and we need them out of here, then things shut down and things change, okay? We saw Bovino get kicked out. We saw Holman come in, and we saw them back out and retreat. So we think a general strike will have the exact same power across the nation. See, right now we got one street filled here on Central Park South, but we want all the streets filled, okay? And that's what, as people's consciousness rises, which this war is really doing, people are seeing the prices go up at the gas tank, and they're putting all the connections together. Imperialism abroad is no good for us, and the federal forces in our streets at home are no good for us. There's a connection. That's why the banner says, "End the war, stop ICE, general strike on May 1st, okay? Let's put all of these overlapping issues together, and let's all band together as a people to shut it down and demand what we need."
Definitely. Can you tell me, what part of New York do you live in?
Yeah, I'm in Queens.
In Queens. What's the sentiment like in Queens right now about the war, the rising gas prices, the cost of living situation?
Oh yeah, people are fed up. It's real, you know, it's real. Like, people are already living paycheck to paycheck. The rent in the city is crazy, we know this. It's tough on working people. So to have a war that no one asked for and we didn't want happen, and then they ask for $200 billion more dollars to put towards the war? No, we need that for our schools, for our parks, for our infrastructure. We need that for the people. And that's what we're demanding here today.
Anything else you want to share about why you're out here today for No King's Day?
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, the people have the power. That's the message today, okay? Not in the annals of Washington, D.C., okay? Trump thinks he owns the world. He thinks he has all the power, but he really does not. When we come together and we demand what we want and what we need, we have the power. So come on out, push for a general strike, and keep your eyes out for the folks and the protests in the street.
I am a public sector worker in one of the most expensive cities in the world. I am a registered nurse, and I support and give public service to our Black and brown communities. I live within the same communities, and we are seeing people unable to afford to live, to get their food, and then are slowly being ineligible to receive support services like SNAP and TANF. So it's a really big issue for our membership. We, as public sector workers, we were inspired by the NYSNA strike, and we want to bring it even further to say that we're done with our tax dollars being spent on war and occupation, slaughtering families, similar workers in similar situations to us in the Middle East, in Iran, and in Gaza. And we want those tax dollars to be spent for our families, for our future, for our communities, so we can live a sustainable life and have a sustainable life for the future.
Breakthrough.
What is Donald Trump thinking about the Iran war? And how does he think? This sounds like a rhetorical question, and perhaps it is. But it's important to understand how Donald Trump is thinking about the Iran war. You might be shocked, or maybe not.
We need a new system. We need a new society. We need to demand that which may have sounded impossible even a few weeks ago, but is not only realizable, but an imperative necessity.
I'm Leanne Seema Fullahan, here with Brian Becker, and this is In the News, a segment of the Socialist Program. The President of the United States gets his daily war briefing, get this, in the form of a 2-minute highlight reel of things blowing up. His staff curates videos of the most successful strikes, edits them, and plays them for him, and then he goes on television and tells the country that the war is won. Meanwhile, $580 million in oil futures were traded in a single minute, 15 minutes before Trump posted that he was in negotiations with Iran, negotiations that Iran says do not exist. And 10,000 U.S. ground troops are now deploying to the Middle East, the largest ground deployment to the region since the invasion of Iraq.
Leanne, this war is widening. It's widening every day. The Iranian military has shown a remarkable capacity, in spite of the fact that thousands of targets have been struck by the U.S. and Israeli bombers, U.S. and Israeli missiles. In spite of all of that, the Iranian military has demonstrated an amazing capacity to maintain what is admittedly an asymmetrical war. The Iranians are pursuing a strategy to impact the global economy. They're striking targets, the U.S. Arab family dictatorships in the Gulf region that are basically, you know, oil wells with a flag on top of them that are dominated by the United States. The Iranians have been able to hit those areas. Iran has virtual control over the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has maintained its ability to hit Israeli targets inside of Israel. And we have talked in the past about the fact that Donald Trump didn't see any of this coming. He thought the U.S. was going to have this big decapitation strategy at the beginning. They would kill the supreme leader and other military and political leaders in Iran. And then, like back in June 2025, he would announce that the war was over. Except this time, Iran has decided that it can't be over, that this is an existential fight, and that if Iran were to accept the ceasefire immediately after this war of aggression killed so many of its own leaders and so many civilians, including that girls' school, if they accepted a ceasefire then under those circumstances, it would just prompt the U.S. and Israel to strike again. So there is a miscalculation on the part of the Trump administration. Iran sees this now as an existential fight. We've said this over and over, and they're going to keep fighting. And Trump did not see it coming. And the world economy is heading towards recession. Now, NBC reported, as you mentioned in the introduction, that the way Donald Trump thinks about the war, makes his calculations, makes his decisions, is not based on some deep grounding of geostrategic politics. He certainly doesn't understand the Middle East. He doesn't speak Farsi or Arabic. He isn't a student of history. You know, that's not how he has understood any of this. His miscalculations are based on a profound ignorance. And his staff, the Pentagon, the real power in America, the military-industrial complex, and the Pentagon establishment, they know he doesn't know anything. So what are they doing? They are, according to NBC, giving him, as you mentioned, a 2-minute video reel every day where things are blowing up. American-Israeli bombers and missiles are blowing things up in Iran, and he gets to see the highlights, sort of like at the middle of the football game on NFL football on Sunday afternoons, you get to see the highlights of who scored what touchdowns, the best tackles of the day, the winning field goal, but you don't see the rest of the game. That's how Trump is being presented with information so he, the commander in chief, can make decisions about what to do next. And obviously, Trump is perfectly content with getting reels because that's about the limits of his imagination. He likes to see things blowing up, and he likes to see that he's winning. So his aides and his staff say, look, we're winning. Look at all of these things blowing up. I mean, that's the level of decision-making right now in Washington, D.C.
And then the I would say funny thing, Brian, but it's not funny because so many lives are at stake. When Trump happens to see the mainstream media reporting on what's happening in the war in Iran and reporting things that he didn't see in his reel. So things like Iran's strikes on, as you said, the Gulf region or on U.S. military bases or on U.S. military infrastructure, Trump thinks the media is lying. So when coverage from the media contradicts his two-minute highlight reel, he doesn't say to his staff, how come you didn't show me that? He just says that the press is lying. So here's an example. Iran struck 5 U.S. refueling tanker planes at a base in Saudi Arabia last week. Trump was not briefed on this. He saw it on the news, and then he went straight to social media and he posted on Truth Social, "The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal in particular and other low-life papers and media actually want us to lose the war. Their terrible reporting is the exact opposite of the actual facts. They are truly sick and demented people and have no idea the damage they caused the United States of America." Well, Brian, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal do cause damage to America because they warmonger and help create a justification for war. But Trump here is attacking them for the completely different reason. He's saying that they're not reporting about America's victories. Basically, Trump has no idea what his war is actually doing, what it's causing, the destruction that it's causing. He has no idea how it's going, but he's the one sitting and he's the one deciding. He's the one pressing the button for this war to continue. So it's a really dangerous situation.
He doesn't know how he, meaning the U.S. military, are actually not succeeding. I think he does know how much suffering he's causing, but that actually pleases him. And it actually pleases Pete Hegseth too. Hegseth, you know, maybe later in the show will play a clip where he's praying for the Pentagon to be able to destroy, to rain death and destruction on the Iranian people, and uses all of these biblical passages about how now this is the time to show, quote, no mercy, no mercy. Anyway, this band of warriors, completely incompetent, completely small thinkers. And, you know, tomorrow on March 28th, there are these No King's Day protests, the next round of the No King's Day protests. Trump is acting like a king, like the king's court knows how to bow and genuflect in front of the court. And if the media says, and as you pointed out, the media is largely supportive of the war, although there are questions and skepticism in the media. And the media does some reporting that is truthful about the impact that the Iranian military has had both on the Gulf states and on Israel. And Trump, like a king, thinks any bad news should be punished and the purveyors of bad news should be punished. So he went even further than the Truth Social post. He says, our media companies, again, the same ones that he was denouncing on Truth Social, who have no credibility whatsoever, are putting out information that they know is false. Now, this is the information that is actually true, but he doesn't like the information. And then he had the FCC, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Brendan Carr, threaten these mainstream networks and told them that they would lose their licenses, NBC, CBS, ABC, for running, quote, hoaxes and news distortions, close quote, about the war.
I think king-like is a very good way to describe it, because that is really how he's acting. Here's another major consequence of Trump's king-like behavior. So if people remember, on Saturday, March 21st, a week ago, Trump gave Iran 48 hours to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, or he'd obliterate their power plants. Blowing up the power plants in Iran would be a huge escalation. It would be off the charts. And the impact on the U.S. stock market was immediate. I mean, it made investors very nervous. Stock futures plunged. Hundreds of billions of dollars were about to be lost. There was a sense of impending economic doom. And in the last month since the war started, the NASDAQ, which is one of the more important stock markets, had already declined by 10%. So the expectation as of early Monday morning at the 48-hour deadline was that there was going to be a huge sell-off in the market. Investors were panicking, and in fact, the sell-off already started in overseas markets in the early hours of the morning.
But then someone, or perhaps it was a small group of people, made hundreds of millions of dollars. Actually, the estimate is more like $1.5 billion, because while everyone in the world thought the stock market was tanking and oil futures were tanking because the war was about to escalate, just at that time, they decided to bet in the opposite direction. They started to bet that the oil futures would come down, meaning the price of a barrel of oil would come down. That seemed to be like an incredible bet. I mean, we were on the verge of like this Armageddon-like escalation. And it was just before this bet was made, just moments before Donald Trump took to social media to announce that the planned obliteration of Iran's power plants was postponed. How did this small group or this person know to bet in the opposite direction? Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, the mainstream media, everyone is talking about the clearly understood notion that whoever made this quote bet wasn't really betting because they had insider information, meaning the ultimate level of corruption. And there's a clip. I want to play this clip from MS Now, which clearly summarizes, I mean, it's a bit understated, but clearly summarizes exactly what happened.
All right, listen to this. Around 6:50 a.m. yesterday, there was an unusual burst of activity in the market. Someone or some group bought large amounts of stock index futures and sold off large amounts of oil futures. Their timing could not have been better. Just 15 minutes later, President Trump posted on Truth Social that he was halting planned strikes on Iranian power plants. The market rallied instantaneously. S&P 500 futures jumped more than 2.5% before the opening bell. And whoever made that early morning bet likely walked away with a massive profit.
This is what everybody in the media is talking about right now. And so on Monday morning, 7 a.m., just before the stock market opened, this is Trump's exact words. This is what he said on social media. He said, "I am pleased to report that the United States of America and the country of Iran have had, over the last 2 days, very good and productive conversations regarding a complete and total resolution of our hostilities in the Middle East. Based on the tenor and tone of these in-depth, detailed, and constructive conversations, which will continue throughout the week, I have instructed the Department of War to postpone any and all military strikes against the Iranian power plants and energy infrastructure for a 5-day period." So basically, Trump went on social media and announced that the war was ending. Those words are very clear words. He says that he's having negotiations with Iran regarding a complete and total resolution of hostilities. That's an announcement that the war is ending. But the whole thing smacks of a big lie, and especially because all Iranian officials completely denied that any negotiations were happening. In fact, they said that not only had no negotiations been happening, they hadn't agreed to any negotiations. The whole thing is a big lie. Trump basically, moments before the stock market opened, and makes this big announcement that the war is ending, the negotiations are happening, the plan to obliterate the power plants has been postponed, that plan that would have destroyed the oil market, it had a huge hit on the oil market. So that really raises the question, was this whole operation, the threat, and then the last minute announcement that the threat is no longer in place, was the whole thing designed to make a lot of money for one of Trump's friends? Was the whole thing designed just to manipulate the markets?
Yeah, it's a question that I think a lot of people are asking, because this is a pattern. It's not a one-time event. Donald Trump threatens escalation, stock markets react, then he pulls back, the markets react again, assuming initially that he's serious, and then he takes it all back. Each time it's timed to when the market seems to open and close. Trump's deadlines consistently align with energy market hours. I mean, this is one of the observations of Mohammad Mirandi, the Iranian observer analyst who we have had on our show in the past. And he's right. And today, Donald Trump announced another pause in the escalation against Iran, a pause in his, you know, planned, his announced intention to obliterate Iran's power plants. But it's not a de-escalation. As you pointed out in the beginning, Leanne, the Trump White House and the Pentagon are sending more than 10,000 ground troops to the Middle East. They're not sending them there for negotiations. They're sending them there to widen the war, to expand the war. And so far, this war has cost about $1 billion a day. That's the estimate. So how long has the war been going on? More than a month. That means more than $30 billion have been spent for death and destruction in the Middle East against the people of Iran. And working families in the United States can't afford rent. They can't afford groceries. Now people can't afford to fill their gas tank because the price of gas has gone up 25 to 30%, maybe more. It's gone up actually about 35% in the last month. Anyway, this war is, of course, mainly costing the Iranian people in the loss of human life, in the loss of the country's assets and resources. But it's affecting the whole world. As we said in our show last week, people in Asia can't afford energy resources. Countries are announcing four-day work weeks. And here in the United States, working class families who don't own stocks, who aren't invested in the stock market, and that would be 90% of the population, they're paying for this war because everything, the price of everything is going up.
That's right. And the situation for people all across the world, and in particular in Asia, is only getting worse. The Philippines yesterday declared a national energy emergency. Here in California, gas is heading towards $9 a gallon. I think the point here is that whoever had the insider information, whoever made $1 billion or more on Trump's media maneuvers, these people are not the ones who are paying the cost of the war. These people are making money off of suffering at a global scale. I mean, that's really what's happening right now.
And the war is expanding in other ways that Trump did not imagine. And of course, the U.S. mainstream media, which is a corporate capitalist-owned media, and many of the media outlets have differences with Donald Trump, but they're not differences about the empire. They're not differences about imperialism. They're differences about tactics. And again, I want to make mention of this. The Pentagon announced that it was diverting or considering diverting weapons from Ukraine, from the Ukraine war, to carry out the war against Iran. Now, the Washington Post said that this is a dire situation, not because it means that more munitions are going to be directed against the Iranian people, but because it showed that the Iran war was depleting critical munitions for the war that the Washington Post supports against Russia in Ukraine. So you have Patriot and THAAD interceptor missile systems being redirected by Central Command, the same systems used in Ukraine. Now they're being diverted to Iran. The Pentagon notified Congress Monday that it was diverting $750 million in NATO funding earmarked for Ukraine to restock U.S. inventories. Now, from our point of view, Leanne, from the point of view of the socialist program, and I hope the entire socialist movement, what we take away from all of this is that it shows that the war in Ukraine and the war in Iran are essentially both U.S. wars, that the U.S. can decide whether munitions and weapon systems can be moved from one theater to another. It shows that even though the Ukrainian government is technically the country and the government at war with Russia, it's the American war, that the Ukrainian government has no say-so on whether those weapons go to Ukraine or to Iran. The Pentagon makes those decisions. So the U.S. is actually engaged in nonstop war, proxy war in the case of Ukraine, a war that the Israelis are waging against the people of Lebanon. That's an American war too. The war against the Palestinian people in Gaza or West Bank, that's an American war. And then the Iran war is obviously an American war because it's a direct, not a proxy war, but they're all American wars.
And the Iran war, as much as Trump is saying on social media that he's coming to an end, and he's been saying in press appearances, it's only, as you said, widening, and all the indications are that it's widening. I mean, 10,000 U.S. troops heading to the Middle East is the largest deployment since the war in Iraq. Then there's the impact of the U.S. war on Iran. I don't think we can end the show without mentioning some of the things that are actually happening. The United States and Israel struck over 9,000 targets already. And now there's reports coming out, there's evidence that the U.S. has been dropping landmines across Iran. There's been landmines found in areas outside of the city of Shiraz, where there's people who live there, people who will be walking there, people who may accidentally step near a landmine and be critically injured or killed, children, civilians. Only the United States has these specific types of landmines, and they have already been seen across Iranian territory.
I want to say one thing real quick before we come to our close here, Leanne. The Ottawa Treaty of 1997 prohibited the use, the production, the stockpiling, and the transfer of anti-personnel landmines. Because landmines kill everyone. They don't kill soldiers. I mean, of course, if soldiers step on them, they kill them. But they kill school kids, they kill civilians, they kill farmers. People don't know what they are. They're scattered about. They step on them or they pick them up, and they lose their legs, their arms, their eyes, or their lives. And so the U.S. government was one of the only governments, and perhaps the only government, that refused to sign the Landmine Prohibition Treaty in 1997, the Ottawa Treaty. And the fact that the U.S. is using landmines right now against the Iranian population, a weapon that does not have a really a strategic impact, but really is on its face crime against humanity. It's designed to kill human beings without discretion. The fact that they did this also is an indicator, I think, that we can't consider this simply Trump's war. Trump didn't decide to use landmines. He doesn't even know about that. They weren't part of the two-minute reels that he's shown. This was the Pentagon High Command deciding to use landmines because they wanted to see their impact. This is the war not simply of the Republican Party, but it's a war of the military-industrial complex. And while we're speaking, Leanne, today, the U.S. Congress, the House of Representatives, went on a two-week recess, even though the House of Representatives Democrats know now that they have the votes to pass a War Resolutions Act against giving Trump authorization for this Iran war. Some of the Republican Congress people, including Nancy Mace, have come out against the war. They could win the War Powers Resolution, and they decided to go on recess for 2 weeks. These privileged, pampered, bourgeois, opportunist politicians went on break, and they could have but did not pass a War Powers Resolution because they actually think that the war is hurting Donald Trump politically. So from their opportunist point of view, they would prefer the war to go on and on because, and they don't care about, you know, hemming in Donald Trump or bringing it to a close because they think it's actually politically beneficial because the country's turned against it. That's not an anti-war position. That's a criminal position.
Breakthrough. We're going to take a quick break here on Breakthrough Radio, but we'll be right back. Welcome back to Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman.
We were there, Breakthrough News, Luis, who's our permanent correspondent there in Cuba. But of course, we had several other people who were there with our team. And one of the opportunities that we had on Saturday was to be able to participate in an interview with Carlos Fernandez de Cossio, who we've had on the show before. He's the deputy foreign minister of Cuba. And he was discussing the escalating U.S. aggression, the long history of economic warfare, Cuba's efforts to navigate and resist it. And we wanted to show a few highlights from that interview here now.
You are witnesses of the situation that Cuba is undergoing at this moment as a result of an unrelenting hostility from the United States, expressed fundamentally with its economic warfare, and more precisely in the past months by a practical and effective energy boycott against Cuba. People many times ask, what is the essence of the problem that Cuba has with the United States? And one could speak for hours about that, including historical background. But if you want to put it in a thin synthesis, it would be the failure, historically and still today, of influential elements within the US political class and government to accept the notion that Cuba is and has the right to be a sovereign country and has the right to self-determination. And that in Cuba, us Cubans, we fully believe in those rights and in those prerogatives. Again, this is a very summarized essence of the problem that you could explain in many ways. What does the US want with Cuba? The restoration of capitalism in the way capitalism was prior to the Cuban Revolution, which was fully dependent on the United States. It was a neo-colony of the United States. And the US also wants a relationship of dependency, to force Cuba to be dependent economically and politically of the United States. You can then go in different areas. You might have the interest of people who don't want or who don't like Cuba's position defending the Palestinian people. Or you have people that, for religious agenda, would want to influence Cuba in a specific way. You have people that are simply find it unacceptable for there to be socialism in this hemisphere or for there to be socialism close to the US. Or you have a group of people that have a revenge attitude towards Cuba, with a nostalgia of a Cuba of the past when it was practically governed by the United States and there was a minute elite that depended on the US, was the privileged elite in Cuba. And again, you could take that in many ways. But the essence of the problem is a failure to recognize that Cuba is and has the right to be a sovereign country. The situation that we face today is of the US and United States applying a brutal aggression based being a superpower against a relatively small country, it's a developing country with few natural resources, and at the same time putting in place a very forceful campaign to try to blame internationally and even domestically in Cuba, to try to blame the Cuban government for the problems facing society today. They know that their policy causes harm, that it causes irritation. If you have 36 hours without electrical power and the consequences of not having then availability of fresh water, if you have problems of transportation to go to work, to take your children to school, if you need a lung surgery and you have to wait for weeks because there's not sufficient power, there's not sufficient health material, in a country that for decades has ensured health services of quality for free for the whole population, then naturally that provokes irritation. It provokes desperation in some people. And in some people, a motivation, a need to protest, which is natural. Anywhere in the world you find that, people would want to protest what has happened. And that is, in many ways, the aim of the policy of the United States. And this is not described necessarily by the Cuban government. It's in official documents of the U.S. government dating back to the 1960s, and it's proclaimed by the current politicians when they say we're taking Cuba to the brink. We're applying so much pressure, and then they say that Cuba will fall on its own. I don't know what the concept of its own mean when you're putting so much pressure on a government to force it to fail. Using the Cuban population as hostages, as victims. Somebody yesterday in the big meeting said, like you would do it in the medieval times, that you try to conquer by forcing surrender through hunger. And that's what they're trying to apply in Cuba. And that's the reality that we face today. If you look at a picture of the UN General Assembly national the voting patterns every year, you have almost unanimous position of the international community rejecting the economic blockade against Cuba. Officially, openly expressed there, year after year. Yet in spite of that, in every country around the world, Cuba runs into the obstacles posed by the U.S. economic blockade. When we go to a bank, I'm not talking only about the government of Cuba or Cuban government-owned companies or even business. Individuals in every country in the world would find one or another banking institution that even if they just go with a Cuban passport to exchange your currency, let's say euros for the national currency of the country, when they see the people there, the clerk, sees a Cuban passport, they'll say, I can't do business with you because I run the risk of getting into trouble with the U.S. And this is, again, in every country around the world. Even the ones you can't imagine, that occurs. Imagine when you try to obtain credit to develop the economy, as any developing country does. When you try to access capital to invest, as every developing country needs, there's a truth said that no developing country can develop itself without foreign investment. If you try to make payments for goods that we purchase for our economy, if we try to receive payments for our exports or for our services, we run in every country, one way or the other, on some occasions, with possibility of circumventing the obstacles, on many times we can't, in trying to develop our economy. And that has gone on for years, it's not something new. The Cuban people would of course not accept the leadership of Cuba, the Cuban government, to be negotiating with another government. Because then they'll say, we don't want you to negotiate it with the US, why don't we discuss it with this other country in Africa, or in Asia, or Latin America that I like more and prefer, but I want it to be closer to that. Negotiate it with us, not with the US government.
Hi, I'm Amin Zazaya with CopperWire. The United States has used its policy of sanctions, especially against Iran, to really rewrite the rules of financial capitalism. Considering the conflict that is happening there, what is your position with respect to collaboration between Cuba and Iran, considering that these are both two countries that have been heavily antagonized by the United States?
We are ready to collaborate with any country that is ready to engage with Cuba to try to overcome illegitimate and illegal coercive measures imposed by the United States against Cuba and against that country, because simply they have no basis, they have no support of any international institutions. These are unilateral coercive measures. And it is a given right to all nations to defend themselves and to try to solve their economic problems without the interference of a third country. We're not sitting down with our arms crossed. We're trying to be as creative as possible, as innovative as possible, mustering the best of our talent and our creativity and our experience to try to cope with a reality which is immaterial. It's not symbolic, it's not rhetoric, it's material, and it's causing huge harm in the people of Cuba, and influencing the attitude, the sentiments, the way of thinking, the conduct of people, and it's inevitable. It is the aim of the policy of the United States to try to solve, with a set of priorities, how to become more independent in terms of generating electricity, which influences the availability of power for water. How are we more independent in terms of not requiring fuel to carry out, to develop our agriculture and the production of food? How do we do the same in terms of transportation, in which case it implies importing vehicles that do not depend on fuel, on combustion energy, but on electricity, if we are able to increase our capacity to generate electricity? We are trying to push forward and accelerate in some cases and open the scope in others in terms of transformations that we have been shaping in our economy that have been lagging and to some extent because of US hostility, and try to make better use of the different sectors of our economy, the different types of property that exist in the country, giving them more space, more interrelation into them, and to try to cope that so that we can improve the economy, ameliorate the situation of the population, and try to sustain the blow. Then you can ask, but can you do this by yourself without a change in US policy? It will be very difficult, but we have to try. The alternative is warfare, military warfare, or the acceptance of the takeover of Cuba. The acceptance of Cuba going back to capitalism. Capitalism is not the future of Cuba, it's a past. And going back to being a client state of the United States, having to ask permission if we're going to import or going to relate or go on an embassy, and as some countries of Latin America have it today, to keep or to open an embassy in Cuba or in some place, you need to ask permission to the master. And that is unthinkable for the Cuban society.
I'm going to end that there. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And just again, a reminder, we are trying to do a spring donation drive, WFT spring donation drive. There will be a match dollar for dollar, $10,000. So if you can donate, go to weft.org. And yes, and click on the blue donate now button. Thank you again to all. Thank you so much to those who have supported us over these years and who've been donating. We really do appreciate it. But that wraps it up here on where we're at, weft.org. And have a good night. I believe Radio Theater is coming up after this. But this is what you're about to hear is Interplay Jazz Orchestra, Bite Your Tongue. But please do keep listening to us here on WEFT 90.1 FM Radio.